Welcome to the first podcast of 2022 for Across the Dietary Universe. Today we have with us Rebecca King. Rebecca, thanks so much for coming on.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat with you.
So Rebecca King is a nutritionist helping adults with ADHD who struggle with disordered eating, chronic dieting, and body image issues. She uses the principles of intuitive eating to coach her clients to form better habits with food and to choose foods that will support their ADHD rather than aggravate it. On her social media, she breaks down myths, stereotypes surrounding ADHD and food, and shares helpful tips for how to have a balanced nutrition, in your diet. So ADHD nutritionist is what she goes by on social media. She's got quite the following and she's got a lot to say. So we're happy to have her on. Is that okay? Did that encapsulate some of what you do?
Yeah, definitely. You definitely covered it.
how did you go about, so first to preface this, I speak to a lot of nutritionists, dietitians, a lot now on this podcast, but even before, and you're the first that really has this niche of ADHD nutrition.
Yeah.
And you probably get this question asked all the time, but how did you become, it's like Spider-Man or Superman Inception story, but how did you become ADHD nutritionist?
Yeah. So I should say I am a dietitian. I just use nutritionist on social media because it's most of the public knows nutritionist a lot of times over like what a dietitian is. But I, 2 years ago, I got laid off because of the pandemic, which was a blessing in disguise for me. And I was like, this is my perfect like opportunity to get started with my own practice. And I started working with a business coach and I knew I wanted to do intuitive eating, which is a very big niche. And then it was like, okay, how can I, you know, get more narrow and specific? And so I was actually working with my best friend and like reflecting on my own journey with having ADHD and disordered eating. And I was like, oh, like started making a connection there. And then realizing that like there was a big component for me of not eating enough during the day on my ADHD meds and then binging at night. And I had a friend who was struggling with a very similar thing. And so then I was like, oh, I might have something here. So I just started doing some market research and some Facebook support groups. And all the women in these groups said they struggled with binge eating. And there's really just no resources the more I dug in for women or adults really with ADHD who struggle with things related to food and nutrition. And so I was like, I'm just going to start talking about this and just see kind of where it goes. And it really took off like a year. I was looking at my memories and like a year ago was like, I hit like 10, not that followers matter to me at all, but like a year ago I had like 10,000 followers. And so it's just crazy to me that there is such a need for this area or this discussion, I guess.
Wow. That's one of those, discoveries that you make that you don't expect to make. And then you sort of just, you know, lift open the, lift up the rock and see what's underneath it. And it's a surprise of, oh my God, so many people are interested in this topic.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like a footnote when you read any like ADHD research on like what you might struggle with when you have ADHD, they'll like focus on all these other risky behaviors. And then it's like eating disorders or disordered eating is like a footnote in the research paper. And I'm like, we eat several times a day, every single day. So like, you would think that that is something really important to talk about. So
I want to jump into that. I want to jump into the weeds really quickly because I'm just like personally super interested in this topic, combining mental health with diet. Of course, we use the quote unquote diet term. A lot of people don't like it, but you know, we know what it means.
Yeah.
I would assume that a lot of people who are following what you're talking about are not necessarily clinically diagnosed with ADHD, but perhaps think that they might be in that category or at least on that spectrum.
Yeah. Is that correct? A lot of people I have, I think there's a lot more conversations around what does ADHD look like on social media now, like especially with TikTok and all of that. Being able to see what you might struggle with, and people are like, oh, I do that, or I struggle with that, or learning how to, you know, and with a lot of people who have ADHD, especially women, will mask some of their symptoms or do all these things to look like they don't appear to have ADHD. And you don't necessarily realize that you're doing it until there's like a name for it and someone talks about it. I'm like, oh, you're like, oh, okay. That's, I didn't realize that other people maybe didn't do that. Like for me, when I was in middle school, I'm a fidgeter and I would bounce around in my chair. And I remember realizing I could chew gum and still move in my seat without it being a disturbance to the others around me. And like those sorts of behaviors, you just start to learn all these different tricks. And I think when the pandemic happened and a lot of our like structure of how our days worked with just going to work and our routines and everything, when a lot of those things got stripped away and we all had to spend time at home and out of those routines, a lot of people really noticed they struggled with things because they didn't have all those coping skills that they could use anymore.
So can you define for the audience who might not be familiar, what exactly is ADHD? A lot of people that I know will just say it like, oh, I have ADHD, but they don't. And they're just saying it because of whatever, they fidget sometimes or, you know, whatever it is. But can you explain like the clinical definition of it and then maybe define a little bit of what that spectrum looks like?
Yeah. So most people imagine ADHD, like the classic, I guess, stereotype of ADHD is like a little hyperactive boy who can't sit still in his chair, you know, blurts out things out of turn. That's kind of like the classic stereotype of ADHD, but it's so much more than just like, oh, I can't focus or I can't pay attention. It's really more of our brains have lower levels of dopamine. So we're constantly seeking out that dopamine. And that means we seek out activities that we like and we find rewarding and we enjoy. And part of ADHD, I guess, as well, on top of that, is just executive dysfunction. So struggling with planning and organizing, being able to regulate our emotions and our self-awareness. So it's a lot more. I usually describe it with my clients. I'm like, when you get diagnosed, it's like an onion and you'll start peeling back all these layers to your life, where you start to be like, oh, okay, that's why I struggled with these things or why I had to spend so much more time doing things than other people, or I did it in a really weird way to get it all done.
Got it. And so when it comes to eating, does the ADHD affect the internal like governor or you know, whatever is controlling the intake of food? Is that what is being affected, or is it just another way for it's another distraction, another hyperactivity to just eat? What's going on there exactly?
Some of it can be impulsivity for people. So obviously, when we're impulsive, like, oh, I want this, and I eat it, and you might eat something before you even realize, like, you did that or made that decision kind of thing. So that can be a component of it, of like, I reach for things really quickly without thinking about it, and it might not be something I wanted to choose to eat, can be one thing. But the ability for us to make food for ourselves and eat, it requires a lot of executive functioning skills. If you think about all the steps from deciding what to eat to going to the store, getting those ingredients, coming home, and the whole process of cooking, and then to get food onto your plate is a lot. And it takes a lot of skills to think through all of those pieces. So I think some of it too is just that it requires a lot of executive functioning to be able to feed ourselves. And so for some people, it can be extremely challenging. And at the end of the day, when you've worked a full work day, coming home and you're usually all of that executive functioning starts to kind of decrease as we get to the evening time. And so it can be hard for people to be like, oh, I need to eat, but I don't have anything ready. And I don't have the energy, or as some people say, like, I don't have the spoons to cook, basically. Right.
So you're trying to make the majority of the decisions, the hard decisions, when you are not depleted and you have, you know, that executive functioning, like the charged battery. You have to meal plan essentially, and you have to figure it out before and not last minute.
Yeah. And even that still can be like, if it's not something you find enjoyable, like the idea of sitting down on like a Sunday or something and like kind of looking at your week of like, what am I going to eat? Like, is like, I'm not like, I can't do, I don't want to do that. Or I, like, my brain is just saying no to that activity. Right. So I will kind of work with my clients on like how to figure out strategies for meal planning that work, because I find like the traditional like meal planning or meal prepping might not work, and having a more flexible approach to it. Like, I'm not like, pick a day and what you're going to make on that day is what you have to make. Cause even for me, I have ADHD. And so for me, if I say tacos are on Tuesday, I might get to Tuesday and be like, I don't want tacos. I want something else. So for me, I pick a couple things. Like, I get a meal kit. So I have like three or four options each week to pick from. And then that day I can pick what sounds good to me, or like what I have the time and energy to cook. And that makes it easier, so I actually do it, or I don't just like, oh, well, I don't feel like making that, so I'll just order takeout kind of thing.
Right. And so the meal kit that you get is just one of those, you know, like chef's plate or something that's prepared in advance, and they...
I go on their little app, and I usually pick the ones that require the least amount of time to cook and make. So that way, in my head, I'm like, okay, if it says 30 to 40 minutes, for whatever reason, I'm like, I'd rather make a recipe that doesn't take as much time. So I've learned to just pick ones that are not as long and involved. And if I feel like doing that, I can go get ingredients from the store and make a more complex meal.
Right, right. Well, if you're feeling up to it. And how much of a factor does stress play? Because everything you described sounds like me when I'm stressed, and I maybe wanted a meal plan and I didn't. And then I get to the Tuesday and I'm just like, like, whatever.
Yeah.
Are people with ADHD more affected by stress, or is it even if there isn't really any major circumstantial stress, they still have that as a, you know, recurring feature in their behavior?
Yeah, I would say it's more of like a recurring feature. Like, stress definitely makes it worse, but even when there's times where you might not be dealing with a lot of life stressors and things like that, it can still be a struggle. It just becomes an extra struggle typically when like those different periods of time come in that are maybe more stressed or more busy or have less time. Right. It's usually just like, for a lot of my clients, it's like, we feel like we have so much to do, or endless to-do lists with things, and keeping up with eating just feels like this almost like a nuisance of a task. Like, I have to stop. A lot of my clients, because they're on, even if they're not on ADHD meds, like being able to pick up on hunger cues and eat throughout the day, they'll be like, you know, like, this is so annoying, is what a lot of my clients will tell me. Like, I have to stop and eat. Like, once they learn their hunger cues, they're like, I actually have to stop and eat this many times a day. This is just annoying. And I'm like, I know it is annoying, but you're going to feel better when you start eating more consistently throughout the day. And that will make the difference in it not feeling as super frustrating.
And that will prevent, you know, like binge eating and other bad cycles of eating food. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of call it the like ADHD binge restrict cycle, where like you know, and it can happen even if you don't have ADHD, but like for a lot of my clients, it's they don't eat much or even at all during the day. And then in the evening, they're ravenous. And I usually call it like the hunger monster that comes out, because it's like, I could eat everything and I'm uncomfortably full, but I still feel like I could keep eating because I didn't eat enough during the day. And then that cycle just kind of repeats itself, because we feel guilty and we feel bad about it. And so the next morning, some people might be like, well, I ate too much last night, so I'm not going to eat breakfast today. And then we just kind of set ourselves up for the same thing to happen.
See this alike in medicated and unmedicated individuals?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see it in both. And a lot of times when I've done like posts and things like that, people be like, I usually refer to it with people on medication in a lot of my Instagram posts, and people will be like, well, I do this and I'm not on meds, but I have ADHD and I usually explain it as like, most people with ADHD struggle with recognizing body cues. Even like going to the bathroom can be like, waiting in young girls, it can be a sign of ADHD if they're like, you know, doing the potty dance, and you're like, you have to go to the bathroom. And they're like, no, I don't. And you're like, you clearly need to go to the bathroom. And then they're like running to the bathroom. And that's something that's very common. And the same thing kind of with hunger cues. I think we're so stimulated by our external environment that we don't always pick up and act on those messages from our body when it's like, hey, can you feed me? And we're like, yeah, let me finish one more thing. It's very common. And so I think meds, if you're on a stimulant medication, it just makes that the ability to ignore hunger or to not even feel it even more exacerbated. But a lot of my clients, even who aren't on meds, are like, I still do this. You know, I still don't eat all day. I just get hyper focused, or I, you know, I lose time blindness is really big. So losing track of time.
It's so interesting how the mind and well, I guess mental, the mental state and your diet and how connected they are. For example, with colitis, that's a, you know, that's a condition of the gut, but it affects the brain and it affects the mind, you know, depression, moods, all sorts of stuff. Right. And then you have something like ADHD, which, you know, you think lives in the brain and lives in the mind, but in reality, it also affects ultimately indirectly the gut, right? Because you, that's the governor of what's controlling. So it's so cool how these are so intertwined. What some of the, like the scientific research that you've seen, has there, have there been a ton of studies on this regarding food and ADHD, or maybe, you know, other conditions?
I don't love a lot of the research because it's not the best designed. Usually the study designs are very poor. They usually don't do like double blind studies when they look at diet, or they don't blind the parents or the teachers. So I think that bias can be really big. So I want there to be more research, because they usually, when they do any sort of like looking at taking out certain like allergens and things like that, like gluten, soy, and dairy tend to be ones that they look at for removing, to see if it helps with symptoms, but they usually remove all of them at the same time in these studies. And so it's like, you can't really figure out, you know, if those, if like, which one is it that is contributing to that? Maybe they all do, but you're not isolating it. And
you don't know for sure.
Everyone's body is different. And so I think, and it's because a lot of people with ADHD are also picky eaters, removing really big groups, if someone's not truly allergic to something, and like, it can be a tricky thing, because a lot of times parents will try some of these diets that are out there that people will recommend, and not work with a dietitian, especially if they have kids. Like the Feingold diet's one that's out there that removes all the stuff. But a lot of most dietitians, like, I was never trained to even use that diet, and it's usually not supported by the literature. The Feingold diet.
Feingold diet, and that's specific for ADHD.
Yeah, and it's an elimination diet that they did a study on, and then most psychologists will agree it's not something you should use. And you should do it in support with a dietitian, and a lot of times that doesn't get acknowledged or recommended, because if you're removing food groups for a long period of time, you still need someone to probably check and make sure that like your growing and developing kid is getting the micronutrients that it needs if you're cutting out certain foods.
Well, I do think
it's, yeah, it's very restrictive.
I mean, I do think there's, you know, we're in the early, early times for more people adopting, connecting with dietitians and making it a part of their lifestyle. Like, you know, even therapy for a while, you know, there was like a taboo and people didn't want to talk. And look now online, there's like a ton of apps and services out there that you can connect to. I think BetterHelp is like one of them. But I think with dietitians, we're going to see the same thing. You know, a hashtag mental health days and stuff like that, that we have in different countries. You know, we will see the same follow with dietitians, nutritionists, and so on, because again, it's like we said before, they're both connected to each other, they're intertwined. It's hard to do one without the other. It's like if you're eating a ton of carbs in the morning, you're gonna crash probably in a few hours, and that might affect your mental state because you're lethargic, low energy, you might not hit your goals, you start procrastinating, and then, you know, that makes you depressed and sad about your progress in your day and your life, and just like this crazy toxic loop.
Food is a very emotional thing too. You know, the messages we hear from people about what we should eat or what we shouldn't eat, or how our bodies are supposed to look, and all of that too, can make it, for a lot of my clients who do struggle with disordered eating, you know, they still try to do all the dieting and all of that stuff, and it can be a bigger struggle because of executive functioning issues. So there's a lot of guilt and shame, or they've their parents have put them on diet since they were a really young age. And so when I work with a lot of my clients, I'm like, it is very helpful, I find, when they also work with a therapist, because we uncover a lot of things where it's like, oh, now I've pinpointed where this struggle or where this thing came from. And now I need someone to like work through it more on the emotional side of things and not just like with the food.
Yeah, that's super cool. I think it connects to the idea of intuitive eating that, you know, you're talking about. So intuitive eating, this is not something that is just for people with ADHD. This is something that everyone could probably take on, right?
Yes. Yeah. Intuitive eating is a non-diet approach to nutrition. So it's kind of the idea behind it is like you are the expert on you. You know, a diet is really great and all these rules and things to follow are great, but it doesn't allow you to listen to what your body is telling you. And so it's kind of coming back to that. It kind of, if you think about it, babies are kind of intuitive eaters, right? So they cry when they're hungry and they turn their head away or they fall asleep when they're done feeding. And then as we get older, we put them on eating schedules. We tell them what to eat, when to eat. Or if you grew up in a clean plate household, like you didn't get to leave the table until you finish the food on your plate. Yeah. And so all that sort of messaging as we get older and older and we start. And then usually there's an age where you start dieting and things like that. And so it becomes very like, don't listen to your body. And that's kind of, you know, dieting or a lot of especially weight loss diets are focused on the idea that like you shouldn't be listening to your body. But a lot of times our bodies know more than what some other person knows, like, you know.
Right. So let's say someone is, because I think sometimes the message does get misconstrued to intuitive eating, therefore anything goes.
Yeah.
This is, I want a cookies and cream Hershey's bar. So I'm going to have it. But
yeah,
how do you reconcile that, which is, I think, the right approach? Because in essence, it's sort of a perpetual, I don't want to say elimination diet, but it's something that is constant. You're testing, you're figuring out and you're hypothesizing, if that's a word, on your body and how that, you know, and how you're reacting to things.
Yeah.
So let's say you have, let's say you have some goals. Let's say you do have fitness goals. You do want to lose weight. And you're like, you know what? I used to be here. You know, I went through university or I went through this part of my life and I got out of hand and I see the old picture of me from a few years ago and I want to hit that. This is like what a lot of people go through, right? But they've developed sort of the wrong habits. So when you say intuitive eating for that person, how does that person now trust themselves to make the right decisions intuitively, because they might not even trust their intuition anymore?
Yeah. And I think that's usually the authors who wrote Intuitive Eating are two dietitians, and they worked in with weight loss, and they would see their patients constantly coming in and out of the clinic. Like as a diet, like you don't want to see people coming back. And my first job was in weight loss, and that was part of the reason I really hated it, was because it broke my heart to see people because you're on the diet. And then once you lose the weight, right, you stop and stop the diet and start eating however you ate before. And then you gain the weight back. And the more we weight cycle like that is actually way more harmful to our health than maybe even being in a larger body.
Right.
So the framework with intuitive eating is kind of the idea that intentional weight loss and dieting doesn't really work. And a lot of the research really does support that. That's, I think, it's about like 2/3 of people who lose weight and end up regaining more weight than they lose in a 10-year period, which is a lot. And if, you know, I can't think of the name of the database, but there's a database that looks at like extreme weight loss and, or people who lose weight, they have a data, like a, I can't think of the name of it, but they, it's like a very small percentage of these people in this group of people that they track their data on. It's like less than 2% are able to actually keep the weight off, which is crazy. So it's kind of a different framework of looking at those behaviors that we might fall off from, like moving our bodies, managing our stress, getting good sleep, all of those things. And how do we implement them? Maybe we don't, our body shape doesn't change, but maybe we feel better. And those, you know, you can still have you can still see benefits to your health without necessarily that weight or the number on the scale having to change. And there's just gonna be, there's definitely like a lot of work that has to go with that,
right,
in terms of body image and accepting our bodies, that comes into play there too.
Yeah, I mean, I think the number on the scale is a vanity metric where it's not really telling you the whole story. And for some, the problem, like for me personally, the issue is gaining weight. Like I've always wanted to gain weight. That's always been my goal, is like, I hate being so skinny. I want to put on the pounds.
Yeah.
And my issue is like, I never eat enough. Like I can just fast for like half the day and I'm like, oh no, what did I just do? So for a lot of people, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
And actually for a while, like I never really saw too much online talking about that reverse aging, because there's a lot of people losing weight, but there's just as many skinny people who are not, you know, super confident in their bodies that want to put on weight too. And I was talking to my buddy who's also, helping me with like personal training and stuff. And I was like, I want to get to, I think I said like 180 pounds. And he's like, okay, but that shouldn't matter. Like that number doesn't actually matter. We can maybe measure you. We can see like muscle mass. We can look at, you know, things that make a lot more sense. But if you're just going to throw this like random number and like whatever it takes to get there, you know, the truth is if you want to gain a ton of weight quickly, just eat like crap. And then, you know, then you end up with the stomach and you don't have any muscles and you look like crap. So
and you probably don't feel great either. Cause I think like you'd mentioned earlier with intuitive eating, of like, it's just eating whatever you want, but it's also connecting with our bodies and like, how does that food make me feel when I eat it? I have the permission and the autonomy to eat it if I want to, but when we're more connected with our bodies, you find that you make more healthful choices with things, because nutritious food makes us feel good. Like if I ate cake and cookies and potato chips all day long and didn't eat anything else, I would feel really gross and probably want some vegetables by the end of the day or something fresh, you know? And so I think that piece always gets kind of missed, of like, well, my intuition just says this. And so a lot of times it is kind of working with someone to learn and get more connected with our bodies, with like, what does feel good, and just doing it in a non-judgmental way of like, hey, when I eat this, how do I feel, you know, afterwards? Does it keep me full for, you know, a long enough period of time till my next meal? Or does it give me more energy? And just being able to kind of figure that out for you. So it is very getting really curious and exploring, you know, that piece of that mind, body and food connection, really.
Yeah. To me, like energy is such a key indicator. Like if I have energy, I'm probably doing something right, not crashing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's usually like, oh, yeah, I'm on the right track.
My mood too is big for me. It's like how impacts it too. So.
Right. So these are some other indicators that people need to keep an eye on aside from vanity metrics. So what are some problematic foods? Because even though everyone is unique, there are problematic foods for people with ADHD, are there?
There are some, and I usually still say like it is an individual thing. So like there might be foods that don't bother you at all. And like food dyes are a perfect example that there is research to support that food dyes might impact ADHD, which is why in Europe they don't have food dyes because of that research. And for Americans, there are food dyes in a lot of our food. But for me, I don't notice a difference in my symptoms if I have it. So it's not like I'm gonna be like, oh, I can't grab a red Gatorade because there's, you know, red number whatever in there and it might make my ADHD worse. It's like, that doesn't make a difference for me. But if it does for someone else, you know, or if you notice every time you have a red Gatorade, you're more hyperactive, then maybe considering cutting or being more mindful of those things. So I'd say food dyes is definitely one where there is some evidence to support that. And there definitely is ways around that. I know like Trader Joe's and Aldi's, and a lot of organic brands are going to be ones that don't contain food dyes. And then sugar is one that I find controversial, because people will say, you know, It's sugar definitely doesn't cause ADHD, but for some people, they find their symptoms can be worse. The research, again, in that area, even is very biased. They don't blind the parents in a lot of these studies. So
Right.
typically, parents will always respond like, oh, my kid does have sugar, so they're being less hyperactive. But even in like a real world scenario with sugar, like if you go to a birthday party, you take your kids to a birthday party, right? The excitement of a birthday party plus having cake and, you know, maybe soda or whatever at the party. My kid's bouncing off the walls, and it's like sugar might be part of it, but they're also with their friends and
Yeah.
having fun and being kids. So
Yeah.
you might expect that. So, and I usually take it more of an approach with sugar of like, how to balance our blood sugars, very similar to like what you do with diabetic patients, with like how to pair foods together to keep your blood sugar stable so that you don't see big peaks and dips in your blood sugar. And that I find can help with managing symptoms versus having to like eliminate it or feel guilty or bad because you might want to eat a cookie with your lunch or something like
Yeah,
that.
yeah. So not to make it enemy number one, but keep an eye on it and see how it affects you.
Yeah, if you feel like, oh, maybe like, because again, like gluten, dairy, and soy are some other nutrients that some people find might make their symptoms worse. And so those things, again, are ones where I'm like, if you notice every time you eat this, there's something happening afterwards, then see what would happen if you don't include that in what you're eating. But it doesn't have to be, I wouldn't say that it's not a blanket. There aren't like necessarily blanket nutrients for everybody.
You mentioned something regarding measuring blood sugar levels. I always thought that, so I understand that diabetics, obviously they have to measure it, right? It's a matter of life and death to do that. But I was sort of thinking, like, shouldn't everyone to some degree, like in the future, maybe this is not going to happen now, but like wouldn't it be cool for everyone to measure and like actually see how the food affects them? And how their energy levels affect it. Because sometimes I've honestly felt so awful after eating. I'm like, I really should not have had that Mr. Noodles, instant noodle ramen pack. I don't buy it
I
anymore.
wish. I have another, I think in the US it's harder to get glucometers and do things like that. I know I've encountered other dietitians that have, because they live in Europe, I guess they might have more accessibility to those things and are able to kind of like do it for their own personal experimentation. But I
Right.
think it is cool to get to do if you ever get the chance to do it, or it is very interesting to kind of get those messages about, you know, those things. And I do think in the future there will be more of that. I know that there are some like wearables that they are looking at being able to detect blood sugar just by like having your watch on.
Right.
And so I think there will probably be a future where that might be more normal information, just like getting how many hours you sleep or like being able to check what your pulse ox is on here and all of that sort of stuff. I think it'll be probably one of those features that starts to get
Yeah.
added in over time so we can measure it.
I always just
I'm
get.
hopeful at least that it is, because
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I think it's definitely going to go that direction. I just think sometimes now, if it's a big company adding in this monitor, that monitor, it's like probably not accurate. Like I have on this is a Huawei watch. So, the brand that's like banned in North America. But it's the Chinese company. I think it's quite good. I think it's quite a nice watch, but it has a VO2 max detector. First of all, like it doesn't make any sense really, because don't you need to like measure the oxygen? But it's saying I'm like a professional. Like I'm gassing out at 5 kilometers and it's telling me my VO2 max is at a professional level. So it's hard
Oh
to know,
yeah,
like,
mine like went up once.
yeah.
Yeah, mine like my Fitbit has like this fitness score it gives me, and like there was a time period where I was being way more sedentary and my resting heart rate wasn't any better, and I was sitting there and I'm like, this doesn't make sense. I was
Yeah.
like, I'm not quite sure. So I think some things are great where there could be things in the future where like hopefully that would be like, you know, pharma companies that do glucometers would be able to provide a better tool that is more accessible to people. Because you could find, you know, it would be a bigger preventative tool too, you know, for people if they think if they're in a pre-diabetic range or getting close, to be able to learn some of those things for people who would find that information helpful.
Yeah, I think it would help us a lot. And even further than that, if we go even beyond the idea that eventually you could have enough in your body, enough sensors or whatever, to recognize what you should eat. Like, it could tell you exactly, like, hey, you need this. Like, you kind of like when you go in your car and you have all these indicators and it's like, oh, tires are low, you need oil, you need gas, you need this thing or that thing. We could potentially have something like that, but like very much embedded in our body. I'm a futurist, obviously. A lot of people are probably hearing this and they're like, don't put anything else in our bodies.
I think there's cool things, like, they're very interesting things that, I think that stuff's kind of interesting. It would be really cool to see. I think too, though, our bodies, we can, even with intuitive eating, like, the more you do kind of learning, like, that turning inward piece and connecting more with food in your bodies, you do start to notice, like, when you need more carbs or when you need more protein, or maybe it's, you know, you notice, like, I might need more fiber, or you know, like, maybe my GI tract's a little bit off, if, you know, depending on where you're at, like, I might need that, or, you know, my energy is really low and maybe, it, you know, or I'm craving more carbs and I haven't been eating a lot of carbs in my diet recently. And usually that can be a sign of, like, when we are craving carbs, like, a lot of people do low carb, for instance, will inevitably at some point they start craving more carbs because their cells are like, hey, we need some, and you're not almost feeding always. It to us.
Almost always.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You have something that you've created called the Am I Hungry or Do I Just Need Dopamine Map? Which is really cool. It's something that's super neat, and I can't go through all of it here, but maybe we can add it in editing, or we'll throw a link to it. I guess this must have had a very, I mean, I see your post has 16,000 likes on this. So it seems that a lot of people, it resonated with them. And is it really true that they're just like, maybe do they, if not food, they just need to like get that dopamine hit somewhere?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, for a lot of my later diagnosed clients, a lot of women get diagnosed later in life. Right. And they, find sometimes that they're like, I've just been a snacker my whole life. And they're like, and I'm not hungry and I don't understand why. And then usually when they get medicated, and even being on like a non-stimulant medication that doesn't suppress their appetite, just having their brain chemicals doing what they need to be doing. And they're like, oh, I'm not, I don't eat when you, like, I'm just not constantly eating all the time or whatever. So it is, sometimes it can be very like a confused message of like, I just need, some of my clients will describe it as they just need something to do with my hands or my mouth. And food is very quick and accessible. And especially over the pandemic, when we've been at home, we don't have access to as much things that give us dopamine or give us stimulation. So I think food has become brought more to the forefront for a lot of people too.
I mean, it seems to either be food or the internet. I mean, those are the two main sources.
Yeah.
And the internet is awful.
That is why I don't have TikTok, because I don't want to. I'm like, it's a great platform, but I was like, I don't want to get sucked into it. And I also don't want to be perpetuating people's scrolling on social media for hours.
Yeah, that's a hard one, though. That's a hard one because...
Yeah.
You're not the, like, you don't own the platform where, like, you're not really perpetuating it. It's really just the algorithms that are perpetuating it. I wouldn't feel bad. I say, hey, go get as many views because you're helping people, right? It's not like you're making just like pure entertainment. I don't think you should feel bad about that. I suggest, see, how do we get to 1 million followers by next year? That's the question.
Yeah. There we go. We might need TikTok for that.
It's ethical. What you're doing is ethical. You're not a Facebook or a Netflix. You're literally trying to emancipate people from themselves. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for me, it's just like finding what works for you. And that's going to look different for everybody, and kind of being okay with that, because we hear just, we get a lot of messages about what we should eat, why, when we should eat, and all of these things. And sometimes those things just don't work for you, even if you don't have ADHD. Like, I think it's important to acknowledge those things or not feel bad, because you, like, I call them shortcuts, like with cooking. Like, you shouldn't feel bad if you buy a salad kit instead of chopping up all of the vegetables and the lettuce and making a salad, or buying a rotisserie chicken so that you have protein to eat throughout the week and you can use it in 3 or 4 or 5 different recipes, you know, and it crosses over well. Or just using those things, or buying like herb paste or pre-cut veggies and fruit for a lot of my clients is so helpful, because usually fruit and vegetables just go die in their fridge because it's too much effort to cut them up and they don't want to do it, or they forget they exist in their fridge. And so I'm like, just take that little extra step, even though it might cost a little bit more money. It might mean that you actually eat those foods, and, you know, eating and nourishing our bodies is a lot better than not.
So. Yeah. I'm with you on that. Been there, done that with the depressed vegetables at the back of the fridge. Just wasting money. It's honestly the worst thing you could do, but everyone does.
Yeah. It's like, I might as well just put, like, I might as well just take this dollar bill right now and put it in my trash can and walk away. And I'm like,
that's the one thing with food. It's like, it's not the intention that counts. You have to eat it. It actually has to go in your body.
Yeah, buying it. If it doesn't go in your mouth, it doesn't matter that you bought it.
Because a lot of times you go to the grocery store and you're like, I eat so healthy, but then like half of it doesn't actually go in your body, right?
Yeah, you're like, well, I got all the stuff, all the other fun foods that I ate. Those all got eaten, but the other things didn't quite make it to the plate.
The worst thing for me, which I've stopped doing because I have now some New Year's resolutions, but like, I'll go grocery shopping and then I'll get home and I'll be tired from grocery shopping. So then I order takeout.
Yeah. I have a lot of dietitian friends that like intentionally do that. And they're like, because they just know that's how, like shopping, they know, they're like, I'm just going to be too tired. Or like I order my groceries. If I do, like, if it's not my meal kit that I get, I order them so that someone else can do the exhausting part for me, and then I get the food and I actually can like make a meal once it gets to my place.
Yeah. I wish I didn't have to
cook. That has been a game changer.
But
yeah,
I'm not one of those, like, I enjoy cooking for other people, but if it's like for myself, it's like, whatever, just fuel. I just want to have energy to do the work. You're doing great work, Rebecca. This is really cool. You. It's nice that you found this niche. And that, of course, you suffer from ADHD yourself, and you've, you know, you're solving your own problem first and foremost, and you're evangelizing and helping, many other people. And I highly recommend anyone, whether they're diagnosed or not, if they have issues with binge eating and they want to have a better understanding of their own bodies, how it affects their mind and so on, check out ADHD.nutritionist on Instagram. And you have a website as well for people to go to, right?
I have a link if you want to work with me. I am finishing my website. That is my New Year's resolution, is to finish my website. I do have one. It just probably isn't very user. It's just in the getting built stages.
This is bit.ly/chatwithbecca. So if you click that, I guess you can book a time to speak with you.
Yes. It's a free 30-minute call. So if you're interested in working with me, that is how you can find me and find a day and time that works for you to chat.
For anyone, any one of our listeners who has invested in a high-risk stock or cryptocurrency or NFT, just forget about that and invest in yourself and your energy and your health.
Seriously.
Because it's much,
it actually will show up and it's real.
It's much lower risk, and Rebecca's great. She's not going to scam you like the NFTs will. It's now a joke on the podcast.
The reward's there too.
This is a running joke now that I'm just taking shots at NFTs wherever possible. To, you know, create a
I was joking with my best friend about them. I was like, so like, does that mean I could just like sell my Instagram content? Like, is that an NFT? I was like, I don't understand. Like, I just don't get it.
I mean, you just got to say blockchain a few times and a leprechaun will appear. Cool. Well, Rebecca, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for being on Across the Dietary Universe, and we look forward to chatting with you soon.
Yes, thank you again for having me. I really enjoyed it.